Okay, I'd like you to turn to Exodus as we continue our study. And I'd like you to take a look at Exodus chapter 7. Chapter 7 begins the story that we know of as the plagues. The Nile's waters are turned to blood. Frogs come out, infest the country. Chapter 8, mosquitoes or gnats infest everything, and horseflies as well. In chapter 9, the livestock of the Egyptians die, but not those of the Hebrews. Boils come, hail comes. Chapter 10, locusts and darkness. And in chapter 11, there's the announcement that it has now reached its climax and that God will impose the death of the firstborn on all Egypt. We talked about all of this the last time we were together. So today we're going to start with chapter 12. And chapter 12, if you start reading it, looks odd. You have the sense that a great distance has suddenly begun to be imposed between what is happening in verses in chapters 10 and 11 and what is going on here in chapter 12. It almost seems as if someone is looking back on these events, because what God does, and it is God who does this, God is speaking and giving instructions. The instructions are for people to notice what is happening and to build a plan to remember it forever. How many times have you been present when something absolutely noteworthy took place? I can remember walking through the lobby of the place where I work and hearing somebody say a plane has flown into the World Trade Center. And thinking, isn't that interesting? Wonder what that Piper Cub was doing up there. Yeah. It was only hours later that I realized the significance of that. Sometimes you don't realize the significance of something until a year later. Sometimes until a decade later. Sometimes until a lot later. If you look back at your life, there have been moments where things happened. And you look back and your whole life was turning and twisting at that point. Because I rehearsed a little bit of this week for one of my students, I'll simply mention one such thing in my life. I was starting graduate school, and I had come into graduate school with what's called the National Science Foundation Fellowship. There is no sense in me bragging about this, but this is something pretty big deal to get, and this is what I had. One of the things this does is to streamline the way through graduate school for a student. It gives you the chance to take away all the distractions and focus on learning the things you're supposed to learn while you're in graduate school. The biggest distraction it takes out of the way is you don't have to teach. Other people have to go and stop what they're doing and plan to be lecture instructors in some courses, not so much in chemistry but in other departments, or to be what we call recitation instructors, recitation section leaders, or lab instructors. You have to prepare to do this. You have to go and spend time with the students who are learning. You have to learn how to do all these things. And having that fellowship, all of that was taken off the table. I didn't have to deal with any of that. So the first week I was at Florida, I went in to see the department chair, and I said, by the way, I think I want to teach in college when I get through. I'd like to be a TA. I don't think his jaw hit his desk, but it sure dropped. My brother was a couple of years ahead of me at Florida in graduate school, in chemistry, in the same department. That's another story. But I saw him and mentioned that I was doing this in the presence of some of his friends who were two or three years ahead of me in graduate school. And without exception, they all said, have you lost your mind? Why would you do such a thing? And I replied, there is at the University of Florida a tremendous, exceptional teacher of chemistry, and I want to learn from this guy because I think I want to do this. They all shook their heads and said, you're crazy. almost everything that happened after that that brought me eventually to Richmond happened because of that decision that moment. I had no idea I was doing some big life-changing thing. I just knew there were some things I wanted to do, and okay, I don't have to do this, but I want to do this. And it turned out it made all kinds of differences. The details of those are not important, but listen again. You read this chapter. You've read this chapter, right? Your instructions were to read all the way through, or at least up to chapter 19. All of you have done that, right?
Yes.
Even on the time when you get married, right? You've taken time to read through this, right? Okay. If you've read this chapter, you realize this chapter does not read like the chapters before it or after it. It reads as if somebody standing a long way away is suddenly with them and saying, some things are about to happen, and you must not forget these things. They are pivotal for the existence of the nation of Israel. And these will be central to its identity, its existence, its purposes for all the rest of time. So, what does God say? Because God is the one who, as if he's coming from a great distance, he's giving them instructions. What does he tell them to do? The first thing he does is to say, let's build a new calendar. And it's interesting and funny. He doesn't exactly throw away the old calendar. He just renumbers the month. The month in which this happens, treat that as the first month in your year from now on. He doesn't move it to where the day that these things happen or come to their climax becomes the first day. The months are maintained, but it just shifts the emphasis. Okay? I've always thought January is a terrible month to start the year. The entire orientation of someone who's a teacher is oriented from September to June. The first of the month. The first month of the year ought to be either August or September. And the end of the month ought to be July or August. That's the way it ought to go. Some of you in the room have a finance orientation. You've worked in banks, or you've worked in CPA firms, or you've worked in investment places. And when you file your taxes, you have to choose, are you going to file for a calendar year, or are you going to file for a fiscal year? And if it's a fiscal year, it's the same sort of thing. How are you orienting yourself? Where does the year start? God is saying, I want to shift things to where the year starts and ends with the remembrance of what's about to happen with you. That was verse 1 and 2. Read verse 1 and 2 of chapter 12. Does this line up with what I've just said? This month must be the first of all months. It's really interesting, that phrase. The first of all months for you, comma, the first month of your year. Has he said two different things here?
No.
I think so. The first month in terms of order, and the first month in terms of importance. All the year builds to this. And when this remembrance comes, and you have remembered properly, then you're ready for another year. And the whole year will build to this recollection again. What does our church's year build from and towards? People outside our church would probably say Christmas. What does it build towards? Easter. Easter. And the parallels between Easter and the events that we're talking about now are huge. The parallels are huge. A new calendar. The key day is not the first day. What's the key day? If you read in here, it's the 14th. It's the 14th of the month. You start doing things before the 14th of the month, but it comes to a culmination on the 14th. Okay? Starting at verse 3, instructions are given to say to the whole of the community, there is going to be a ceremony, a new ceremony. You've got a new calendar, or at least a new orientation toward the calendar, a new ceremony. And what the ceremony is going to do is to reproduce for each new year, for the people who are new, reproduce the things that are about to happen to you in the next few days. What are the things that are about to happen in the next few days? We've had 9 plagues. Here comes the 10th plague. What's the 10th plague? The firstborn of Egypt is going to die. Well, it seems like that's easy enough. God says, hey, listen, just get out of the way. I'm going to kill the firstborn of Egypt. But that's not what God does. And what is described in chapter 12 is the instructions for the people, because the people have an intimate participation in this event. What do they have to do? They have to find and choose a lamb. Now, they're allowed to choose a lamb or a kid. That would be a goat or a sheep. But the orientation is that you choose a lamb. You choose a lamb. And what do you do with the lamb? It dies. That's the most gentle way that I can say it. It dies. And what do you do then? Two things. You take its blood and you put some of that blood where? On the posts of the door, on the lintels and posts of the door. And what do you do with the rest of the lamb? You eat it. And nothing left over, if it's left over, you throw it away. Right? Why do you put the blood on the doorposts? What is the name of this? I hope this is not a mystery to anyone in the room. I hope not. What is the name of this ritual, this ceremony, this act of remembrance? It's called Passover. Okay, I'm being real fundamental and real basic here. Work with me. What got passed over? The homes where the blood of the lamb had been applied to the door. What happens to the homes where the blood of the lamb had not been applied to the door? Those homes weren't passed over. Passed over by whom? You can take a look, if you will, at verse 23. Way down in that verse is the first time you hear it. And you don't hear it very much. When the Lord goes through Egypt to strike it, and sees the blood on the lintel and on both doorposts, he will pass over that door and not allow, and right there's the name, the destroyer, the death angel, whatever that means. Death was coming, and death passes over those houses. There's a special meal. Verses 8 and 9 talk about how to eat that lamb that was killed or slain. Or slaughtered. Very specific instructions for how to cook. Do not eat any of it raw. Do not eat any of it boiled or water in water. Lamb sushi is not allowed. Roast it over the fire. And what do you eat it with? Unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Why that? Well, it goes on. If you keep reading in this chapter, it goes on and tells you that. And it tells you that in the most interesting way. Way down in here it says, the day will come when you are far from here in time and space, in a land far away that God has prepared for you and that you will have. And when you're in that land and you do this ceremony, you reconstruct and reenact the things that are going to happen in the next day or two. Your children will ask, what does all of this mean? And you are to tell them. And it begins to say, why the unleavened bread? Uh-oh. There wasn't a quick answer. Because you didn't have time to let the bread rise. Now, in another place, it says when you reenact it, you would have had time to let it rise. So what do? You leave out the leaven. But on this particular day, presumably the bread would have been prepared, but there wouldn't have been time to let it rise. And over again in the chapter that follows, this chapter and the chapter that follows, it says at least three places, I think, that when they left, and they are leaving very soon, they carried the bread in bowls on their backs. That picture, something about the bread is important. What about the herbs? Why bitter? Well, I don't know here. I really don't know. I can remember for years my mother trying to get me to eat spinach. I don't think that's an herb, so don't, you know, those of you who want to be purist and take issue with weight, that's not an herb. I'm going someplace else. Hate is a little too strong. Detested comes closer. I didn't like spinach the way my mother cooked it. And so I assumed I didn't like spinach. I found out years later, I really like spinach. As long as it's not cooked. Because when it was cooked, it had a taste that to my... When I think of these bitter herbs, I think of that spinach my mother used to try to make me eat. If she had just tossed a salad with the spinach leaves, how much sweeter my childhood would have been. Why bitter herbs? Because our existence in Egypt had been so bitter. And it's reminding us of that. Verse 14 calls the remembrance a feast. Does yours use that word in verse 14? Not much of a feast. Rapidly cooked lamb, unevenly cooked probably. Unleavened bread, bitter herbs. That doesn't sound like much of a feast, but that's what he calls it. And why? Why would he call it a feast? Why would God call it a feast? When you use the word feast, what are you implying?
Celebration.
Celebration. Does the food have to be great or abundant for it to be a feast? Not if what you're celebrating is joyous enough. They're about to leave. And they're about to leave under horrible circumstances. Egypt is in mourning because the firstborn of Egypt has died. There's an old hymn that the chorus says, "Glory to His name, glory to His name. There to my heart was the blood applied. Glory to His name." You remember that hymn? Down at the cross where my Savior died, down where for cleansing from sin I cried, there to my heart was the blood applied. That's echoing what happened to the doorposts. It's echoing that. Death passes over, life comes. The parallels to Easter, when Jesus is described as the Passover lamb for all the world, parallels are there. Verses 15 through 20, very specific things are talking about, and it's not this in this section, it's not talking about what's about to happen to the people. It's talking about what are you going to do years from now in another time and place to remember what's about to happen to you here. And starting in verse 21, Moses passes all these instructions on. How does he pass them on? To the elders, and the elders passed them on to the people. Anybody read ahead enough to know how many people there were? The number that's given is 600,000. And then there's a pause and it says, oh, by the way, that's just the men of fighting age. It doesn't count the women and the children. It doesn't count the older people. And it doesn't count the livestock. Hundreds of thousands of people. And the word's got to go out to them quickly. Go back and take a quick look just before we pass over it. Look at verse 10 and 11, still in chapter 12, verse 10 and 11. My translation starts verse 10 with, "This is how you must eat it." Earlier on, it's been saying, "This is how you should cook it," although it doesn't exactly use those words. Verse 10, mine says, "This is how you must eat it." Does yours have some phrase like that? Okay. So the next phrase is going to be, "With a fork in your right hand and turn your head this way and chew this many times." No. What does it say? "This is how you must eat it." What's God saying here? Ready to go somewhere you've never been. And to go there forever, and to go there just carrying what you can grab and run with. don't remember what day in September it was, the 18th, I think. I'm pretty sure the year was 2003. Remember what you were doing that day? Hurricane Isabel was hitting. We had a tree nearly cut our house in half, and some of you know that because some of you had more trees land on your house than we did, right, Mike? I started to realize there were things in that house I didn't want to get wet or crushed or other things. And so, with the help of somebody I never should have asked for help, right, Clark? I got all that stuff out to my van and tried to park it in a place where a van wouldn't get hit by all the trees that were falling. Turned out that worked. But, you know, what do you grab when you're going to run? I'm not saying Isabel and this are parallel, but I am saying something of what I felt that day. If I just have to grab something and run and never come back, what do I grab, what do I take? That's something of what he's saying. So eat the meal under the circumstances that remind you we were about to just get up and go. We've been praying for deliverance. We've been praying for freedom. When it comes so fast. There was no time to prepare. That idea just runs all the way through here. You're not the first one to say that, but you're the first one this morning. Yeah. Okay. Verse 24. Moses in verse 21 says to the elders of Israel, go to the people and here's what you tell them to do. Verse 24, and you will do this again and again every year from now on. This is a decree binding you and your children for how long? For all time. Forever. And when your children ask, this is verse 26, what does this ritual mean? You will tell them, and it tells you what to tell them. Verse 28 tells you what? It's a very simple statement. What does verse 28 tell you? The people were obedient. They did. 600,000 men of fighting age, probably close to 2 million total people. You want to try to get everybody in this church to do something with 24 hours notice? Even to get the word out to them, and we've got way better words and ways of communicating. All this is done in a very short period of time, and everybody does it. Everybody obeys. Verse 29, the death angel comes. The destroyer comes. And who is struck? All the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, the heir to his throne, to the firstborn of the prisoner in the dungeon, plus all the firstborn of the livestock. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night. There was great wailing in Egypt, for there was not a single house without its dead. It was still dark when Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, up, leave my subjects. Leave you and the Israelites. And then there's a phrase I want to make real sure you see. I've said this the last time we were together. I want to make sure I get one more chance at saying this. We have this picture in our mind that what Moses shouted to Pharaoh was, let my people go, and that is not what he said. That is not what he said. What did he say? Let my people go and worship God. Pharaoh heard that. What does he say here? This is verse 31. Leave my subject, you and the Israelites. Go and worship God as you have asked. Verse 32, and take your flocks and herds as you have asked. Go. And then there's the most astounding statement that most people miss. Bless me too. I think you have a grieving father who recognizes there is a power here that he could have averted if he had not had a hardened heart. And somehow he realizes, in all of this, there's still a blessing if I ask for it. I think we probably ought to spend a lot more time than I'm going to on that little phrase. Pharaoh, recognizing what the people asked, go and worship God as you asked. Take your livestock and your herds as you asked. And bless me too. That's an astounding statement. That's an astounding statement. Verse 34, notice the focus on unleavened bread. This is the first time I think it talks about carrying the dough in bowls. Verses 35 and 36, very interesting verses. What happens here? God had told the people, had told Moses, this is what would happen. Now it says it happened. The Egyptians are essentially ejecting the Israelites from the country. It isn't you can go as much as get out. And the people said, give us your jewelry, give us your treasures. And they stripped Egypt of its treasures on the way out. God said that would happen. Later, when God begins to give directions for furnishing the tabernacle, the first physical worship place the people had had, he asked the people to give gifts. They were penniless slaves. All of a sudden, they're rich. They have something with which to give. It's been given to them by the Egyptians as part of kicking them out of the country. Verse 37, where did they go from? Ramesses. Where did they go to? Succoth. Where is Succoth? Answer, nobody knows for sure, but the best guess is it's about 25 miles to the southwest. That if you can picture, I'll try to picture this a little bit. If you can picture the Nile Delta, sort of like this, that Ramses was up in here, and that over here was something. If you have the current Suez Canal, which connects the Red Sea down here with the Mediterranean, it would be right on the edge of the Suez Canal. It would be right on the edge of the Suez Canal. This, nobody knows for sure, but that's sort of the best guess, about 25 miles away. Okay. Please look at verse 38. This is something I do not know what to tell you, except I know I need to point it out. Who left Egypt that day? Answer is, it looks like it wasn't just the Israelites. When you have a slave population and you have a powerful country that has enslaved them and you're talking about this period of time, chances are the slaves that you've got didn't all come from one place. And it looks like a lot of slaves were set free. How many of that 600,000 were Israelites and how many weren't? Nobody talks about that very much, but it looks like part of them, some of them were, or else they were in addition to that number. Because it says in my translation, a mixed crowd of people went with them, along with flocks and herds and quantities of livestock. A mixed crowd of people. What does your translation say there?
Many other people
went with them. Okay. Any other translation?
A mixed multitude.
That mixed word, or that many other people, most commentators who notice this and say something about it say these were other people who were enslaved along with the Hebrews, that the Hebrews were the major group that was there. In fact, maybe even the large majority, but they weren't alone. And there was a mixed crowd that went with it. It could be that they're talking about a mixed crowd of people who were faithful and less faithful. It could be talking about a mixed crowd in terms of age and such, but most commentators think it's talking about other nationalities, other slaves coming out with them.
Fred? You know, I've got a footnote to speculate that it could have been some people that were mentioned in chapter 9, verse 20, where it says, "Those physicians of Pharaoh who feared the word of the Lord heard you when your slaves lost and not your side."
I had that thought yesterday and I forgot to say it here. It could be that those who had been overseeing them and had seen their powers had heard Moses speak. It could be that some of these were even some of the Egyptian overlords. That's true. I'd forgotten that. Thank you for reminding me. We don't know, but it looks like there were more than just the Israelites there. I don't know what to do with that. When did they go? Verse 40 and 41.
When did they go? When did the first foot leave the ground to come down 1 footstep away and the journey begins? 430 years to the day from the day in which Israel or Jacob first set foot in Egypt. 430 years. Those of you who heard that number coming as we've been back in earlier chapters, this was where it came from. By the time you get to verse 42, the instructions are back to, and here's what you're going to do years from now in another time and place. The night when the Lord kept vigil to bring them out of Egypt must be kept as a vigil in honor of the Lord by all Israelites for all generations. Then in verse 43 and 44, it talks about who can eat and who cannot. Okay. Verse 50, what does it say? Everybody did. There's a miracle right there, although nobody often finds it that way. Chapter 13 is where we move now. Chapter 13 is very, very interesting. It's still talking about years from now in another place. What are you going to do that helps you remember this? And God is putting a few more things in. What's the first? Chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. The firstborn from now on will be dedicated, yours says.
Sanctified. Okay. Consecrated.
Dedicated, consecrated,
sanctified.
To God. Remember what happened to Samuel, those of you who know something about the Bible already? His mother dedicated, consecrated him, actually gave him to Eli to serve within the temple. That's probably part of this. But if you come just a little bit further, if you come down to verse 11, 12, and 13, there's a lot in here that talks about the rituals and ceremonies that will come in years to come. Lots of that. Verse 11, 12, and 13, when the Lord has brought you into the Canaanites' country as he swore to you and your ancestors that he would, and when he has given it to you, to the Lord you must make over whatever first issues from the womb. Every firstborn cast by animals belonging to you, those males belong to the Lord. Every firstborn donkey you must redeem with a lamb or a kid. If you do not redeem it, it must die. What do you do with humans? Those aren't given over to the Lord. What happens to them? What's the word? I think this is in verse 13. The tail end of verse 13.
Yeah,
the word is redeem. Okay? What do you redeem a donkey with? We just passed it. A lamb or a kid. What do you redeem a human child with then? Firstborn. A lamb or a kid. What if you can't afford a lamb or a kid? Use a turtle dove. When Jesus was 8 days old, what did his parents do? They took him to the temple, and they went through this ancient ritual. And what did they use? A dove. What does that tell you? Jesus was firstborn. What else does it tell you? They were poor. Okay, all that echoing back from all this. Verses 3 through 10 and also 11 through 16, Moses is speaking to the people. Remember this day, the day on which you came out of Egypt, the day on which you came from the place of slave labor, for by the strength of his hand the Lord brought you out of it. And then once again, don't eat leavened bread on this day. It talks about where they're going. Talks about a 7-day ceremony, a 7-day feast with the celebration of Passover in the middle of that. Verse 14 of this chapter of 13 echoes what we saw back in chapter 12. When your son asks you in days to come, what does this all mean? Which son is likely to ask this question? Probably the one that's been dedicated, the one that's been consecrated, the one that's been redeemed. Probably that firstborn son. What does all this mean? Here is what you're to tell him. All this is being provided for. So far, okay? All right. Verse 17, we finally get to the departure. Most everything back between here, verse 17 of chapter 13 and before, has been getting the people ready for remembering 100 years, 1,000 years into the future, what's going to happen this day. But finally they begin. So, who leads them? Moses, right? Nope. Who leads them? I'm looking only at verse 17. No, Pharaoh let the people go. Who leads them? God leads them. That seems odd to my ear. Does it to you? God did not let them take the road to the Philistines' territory, although that was the shortest. In case God thought the prospect of fighting makes the people change their minds and turn back to Egypt. Instead, God led the people in a roundabout way through the desert of the Sea of Reeds. The Israelites left Egypt fully armed. How could they leave fully armed? They were slaves. When they asked the Egyptians, give us your treasures, along with that came all the arms they need. They were fully armed. They hadn't learned how to fight, but they had the arms. Moses took with them the bones of Joseph, and they set out, verse 20 says, from Succoth, and encamped at a new place called Etham. Where's Etham?
Etham is kind of here, 10, 15 miles further off. Now you have to, this is the Suez Canal, so that wasn't there. That wasn't there in those days. That wasn't there.
And verse 21 and 22 finally gets to what Judith was telling us a moment or two ago. How did God lead them? Pillar of fire by day. Pillar of fire by night. Pillar of cloud by day. So that was two different things, right? One thing. During the day, you couldn't see the fire that was producing the smoke. During the night, you could see the fire that was producing the smoke. Or at least, that I think is most likely. God is leading them. Whenever the pillar of cloud or fire moves, people move. There is evidence here, it's hinted at, in a couple of places it's more than hinted at, that the people moved day and night. For a brief time, I had the privilege of serving in the United States Army. Some of you had the privilege of serving more extensively and more significantly than I did. But I can remember marches. Any of you guys serve in the military remember marches? How would you do a march? You go 10, 15 miles, then you'd rest a little while. These were people who'd been slaves, right? Are they ready to do this kind of marching? Yeah, I think so. What have they been doing? They've been doing hard labor. Their muscles are built up. Their endurance is built up. Probably they could do this. But I still think they probably moved. But one group would move, another would. At this point, I found myself thinking of a guy named John Farmer. And I don't know if any of you even know John Farmer. He worked for Dominion Resources for years and years, may still be working for them for all I know. I used to go on hikes with a group that John Farmer was one of the leaders. We'd set out on the hike. I remember specifically Dolly Sods up in West Virginia. We were up on a mountain plateau 3,000 feet. And John would just take off. He always came, we were going to camp out, and he came with this little bitty backpack that had everything in it he needed, and we were sitting there loaded down with 60, 70 pounds of stuff we thought we couldn't get along with. And John would, he never seemed to rush, but he would be out of sight within just a few minutes. He'd be gone. And we'd go half a mile or so, or a mile, and we'd come, and here's John resting up against a tree. And the moment we showed up, John was gone. Now, I heard a commentator describe the movement of the people as being something like an accordion. Right? What happens with an accordion? I think rush hour traffic might be almost as good, but that idea, you go for a little while, you slow down for a little while. But how far could you travel? 25 miles might be a stretch, but 25 miles probably the maximum for a day. So you're talking days travel for each of these things. He did not take them by the shortest route.
What was the shortest route? The Philistine country was up here. We'll call that PC, the Philistine country. The shortest route would have been that route. He didn't take that route. He took this route. Down this way. So far, okay? Why? God said why? Not the Philistines. In case, this is verse 17 of chapter 13, in case the prospect of fighting makes the people change their minds and turn back to Egypt. What kind of country were they going through? Not so nice. Which means the thought of going back instead of saying wherever you happen to be. Okay. Now, chapter 14, the Lord spoke to Moses and said, tell the Israelites to turn back and pitch camp at a certain place. Lots of big words.
Lots of big words. Turn back. What are they doing? They're turning back and they're coming to a place sort of here. And next to that place is a nice, big, swampy lake. About 6 miles across. Still some distance from the Red Sea. There are big mountains to the west. There's a 6 mile wide lake to the right. Interestingly, my picture is it's probably about the size of the Lake of Sea of Galilee. About that size, maybe. And there is desert, impenetrable desert to the south. And they're camped right here on the shore of the lake. As a military person looks at this, what might they think? You put yourself in a trap. And what happens?
Here comes Pharaoh from the north. Because Pharaoh has had a change of heart too.
And chapter 14 takes you through this. God spoke to Moses. God never does anything without disclosing to his servants, the prophets, what he's doing. He says to them, the Israelites, you must pitch your camp opposite this place besides the sea. That is, it's either the Red Sea or this big lake, which of the two. And then Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering to and fro the countryside. The desert is closed in on them. I'll make Pharaoh's heart hardened, and he will set out in pursuit of them, and I will win glory for myself at the expense of Pharaoh and his whole army, and then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. That is repeated in verse 18. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. Now, here's your assignment for next time. Something is about to happen, and I want you to search through chapter 14 to find out four things. Number one, when Pharaoh's army came close enough that they could be seen, what was the reaction of the people? Number two, what was the reaction of Moses? Number three, what was God's view of things? And number four, what happened then? Chapter 15 is Moses' song of celebration. So the fact that it comes out pretty good, I'll give you that fact at the front end. All right? Let's have a word of prayer before we go. Our Father, we thank you for the words that we've read today. We find ourselves reading of things that happened thousands of years ago. And it seems so distant, and yet at the same time, something about it seems fresh. And we start to think, maybe it's because the things that happened to them are examples for us to learn from, because similar things might happen to us today. Help us understand when we're trapped between a rock and a hard place, and a sea that can't be crossed, you're still with us. And you have things that you're going to do that you could only do. And we are the ones who can marvel and then remember forever what we've seen and what we've experienced. Teach us to remember. Teach us to witness to the things that you have done in our lives. For we ask this in Jesus' name.